Star Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for folks traveling through Fresno on 41 and 99 right now wondering, is this program live? It is. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your Friday morning 2 hour tour begins right now, 4 minutes 47 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Good morning to you. I am the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel, delighted to be with you. Beautiful morning here in the Central Valley of California, and I hope it is equally beautiful wherever you happen to be listening to us as you start your day. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, he's a Sharks fan, Giants fan, and he's an expert on both The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. Not many people can have that combo platter. Russ, keeping this program going in the right direction. On the program this morning, our weekly encore at 7:35 this morning. It'll be Derek Carr, and it'll be the full Derek Carr. I know that a lot of you saw that on my SoundCloud page. We put the football portion of it up, but I want you to hear all of it because the first 4 or 5 minutes are Derek talking about Inside the Huddle, which is the annual event that him and brother David host up at, this year it's going to be at Valley Children's as opposed to being downtown, an intimate event where you get to go one-on-one with both Derek and David. They're going to be breaking down film. You're going to be able to take pictures. Your admission price, there's only 100 tickets. And you'll get all the details when you hear Derek. But it's a chance to win some fun goodies, to eat some great food, to have a beverage or two, and just to have a really good time in a very intimate setting. But the bottom line of the event is that it's a tremendous cause. When you purchase a ticket for this event, your money is going right to Valley Children's Hospital and nowhere, Valley Healthcare. I always, you know, it's Valley Children's and it's Valley Children's Healthcare, but I always want to say Valley Children's Hospital, but you all know what I mean. What's great about this event is that every penny goes to Valley Children's. It's a wonderful event that Derek and David put on, so you'll get all the details of that, as well as some great Raiders talk at 7:35. If you're a Raiders fan, even if you're not in the Valley, you certainly or most likely are a Derek Carr fan and a David Carr fan, but this is some good stuff with Derek. Probably the best conversation that I've had with Derek. I've had three of them, so a lot of fun. Always appreciate him taking some time to join the program. 8:05, it's Friday Picks with our good friend Tony Landry. He is the producer of Big Ten This Morning for Sirius XM. We're going to give you the conference championship game picks. We're also going to give you a couple of basketball picks. One college, one NBA. 8:35, we'll check out the movies this weekend with Nick Shager. Not a lot of great openings, but there's a couple good ones. We're also going to talk about, it premiered on November 29th, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it yet. The Last Days of Night, the great 30 for 30 piece on ESPN, and a lot of it, you'll hear a lot of the account from Heather Dinich, who went to Indiana University and who, back in 2000, her and several members of the Indiana Daily Student, the student-run newspaper at IU, they have a great journalism school at IU. A lot of remarkable writers came out of that program. Heather is one of them, and a lot of the perspective that you get on that show comes from Heather and comes from a sit-down that she and several other members of the Indiana Daily Student had with Bob Knight when he got fired. It was on his back porch. Sloppy Joe's and some soft drinks were brought by Bob Knight's wife. I think Karen is his wife's name. And it's really a remarkable piece, and she has a lot to say about it. But these 30 for 30 films, these 30 for 30 films are just so well done. They're just so brilliantly done, and we'll talk with Nick about that. One more thing at 8:55. As long as I'm talking about Bob Knight a little bit, you know, when I was growing up, these were the types of coaches that I watched on TV. You know, we didn't have I wasn't growing up in the 1950s, but when I was growing up, we didn't have the kind of TV that we have now, and I think a lot of you can certainly appreciate that. You remember. But when I was growing up, and talking about Bob Knight, these were the types of coaches that I watched on TV. They were the ones that I read about. And as a basketball player, they were the ones who coached me. And ultimately, most of those types of coaches, the Bob Knight type of coach, the polarizing, hard-driving, bully-like coach, most of those were the ones who recruited me as well. And over the years, I've thought about it. I thought about my plan. I mean, going back to my, you know, we didn't call it middle school then. It was elementary school. It was all the schools were K through 8. And you had your teams that start, your school team that started in 5th grade, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And then you got to high school. That was the kind of coach, Bob Knight, that was the kind of coach that I had 5th through 8th grade. And I look back, and I think, was my coach a bully, or was he just a coach who was trying to make us all better as players? Back then, the high school that our school fed into, there were four elementary schools that, you know, the fifth through eighth grade teams that fed into the high school that I would have gone to had I stayed in Illinois. And that school was a basketball powerhouse. And it was routine then for the coaches, and I think it's very routine now, but where we think now, you know, high school coaches are already looking at the middle school players. This isn't new. This is not a new habit or style. But we knew the coaches, and the coaches... we knew that the coaches, we assumed the coaches at our school, the head coach and his assistant, were yelling and screaming at us because they wanted us to be better and they wanted us to be really strong players at the high school level. But they screamed at us. They criticized us. They demeaned us. Sometimes they got a little physical with us. They'd give us a little bump. They'd take a finger and they'd sort of tap you on the bridge of the nose. We expected all of that. Isn't that crazy? Can you imagine your son or daughter either coming home now and saying, yeah, Coach so-and-so gave me a little rap with his knuckle or finger on the bridge of my nose. Can you imagine what your reaction would be now? I know what my reaction would be, but it's a different time. It's a different era. Things are different now. We just expected that. I had an incident like that once at practice when I was in eighth grade. I remember it to this day. My dad... Then and now, even my dad at 85 years old, my dad is born and raised South Side of Chicago. He's tough as nails. I mean, he is a South Side Chicago guy to this day. And I remember telling my dad, not looking for any kind of sympathy about it. That's just the way it was. I grew up in a tough Greek family, and that's, you know, the way my coach was the way my dad was. But the point is, I remember telling my dad about that little rap on the bridge of the nose. I was the point guard on our team, and I remember telling my dad about it. I'll never forget what he said. I mean, he looked at me and he said, whatever coach said, whatever he did, you deserved it. Get tough or get out. And that was the attitude. That was the attitude of parents. and family members, and that was the attitude of coaches. Well, that brings me back to Bob Knight, because on September 7th, 2000, Bob Knight, he was accused of grabbing a freshman student, Kent Harvey, grabbed him by the arm and broke this zero-tolerance policy that had been handed down by Miles Brand, the university president at the time. And the way that all started was he was walking into Assembly Hall, IU's basketball arena. Harvey was 19 at the time, and he looks over at Bob Knight. He yells, "Hey, Knight, what's up?" Now, you just didn't do that with Bob Knight. Bob Knight was the king, or so he thought, at IU. And the students who were walking along with Kent Harvey said that Knight went over to him, grabbed him by the arm, kind of dragged him aside, and said, "You show me some bleeping respect. I'm older than you." You know. But you look at what Knight was like then, and every coach wasn't like him. I wasn't good enough to be recruited by a Bob Knight. I think that I probably, just because of the way I grew up and the coaches that I had in elementary school and in high school, probably would have done fine with his personality because that's what I was used to. But when you look at him and you look at the polarizing personality that he had and the stubbornness that he had for any kind of authority, the arrogance that he had, the way he ran IU, you know, he said that he considered himself, and he said this on tape in an interview with Heather Dinich and two other students at IU when they were doing this interview with him back in 2000 after he got fired. He said, "I consider myself," and I'm paraphrasing, "the athletic director of the basketball program." And he said, "I do the hiring, I do the firing, I do it all. That's how we set this thing up." And I'm not so sure that he was, in terms of the totality of power that he had, was he any different than Woody Hayes? And I'm not talking about the overall personality, but in terms of the power that he wielded, was he different than Woody Hayes or Bo Schembechler or Bobby Bowden or Joe Paterno? What about Nick Saban or Urban Meyer, his years at Ohio State and Florida before that, for that matter at Utah? Or Jim Harbaugh or Mike Krzyzewski or Roy Williams at North Carolina, Jim Boeheim at Syracuse? Everybody that I just mentioned, they all have one thing, a strain of commonality that runs through all of them. And that's they all own their programs. They own their towns. Their identities are completely indistinguishable from the schools that they work at and for. They are the kings of their universities. And when I look back at Bob Knight, when you see the career that he had. He won national championships. You know, you look at the good side of Bob Knight. He won national championships, and that was good for Indiana, but he graduated players. You were a player for Bob Knight. You went to class. He personally would visit classrooms to make sure his players were there. He didn't just send assistants. He went. His players, some of his greatest supporters, especially Isaiah Thomas, you know, the great player who was on the undefeated Indiana National Championship team. You know, he would say that he would talk about the things, and other players would talk about the things that Bob Knight did that nobody ever heard of. The endless visits to schools to talk to students. The endless visits to hospitals, to talk to kids in hospitals, the endless amount of money that he would donate for a variety of charitable causes. And it's not that he was doing anything that was different than anybody else, except you didn't realize he was doing those things because he didn't publicize them. But he told the Indiana Daily Student back in 2000, and this is a direct quote, and I think it's very telling about what he was like, and I think this is probably representative of every coach that I just mentioned. Excuse me. Bob Knight said, I have never been from day one, and he paused, and he said, I'm not the coach for this administration, but I'm the coach for our program and what we tried to do. The academic record we've established, the record for success after graduation we established, and I think my pride in that carried away my better instincts relative to whether I should stay here or look for employment somewhere else. And what's the irony of Bob Knight is that he's a guy who, he demanded respect. He installed a policy of discipline that was like his upbringing and his college years at West Point. He demanded players kept their emotions in check. And yet, what was his ultimate undoing was that he couldn't keep his own emotions, temper, personality in check. Couldn't do it. But I think the broadest point here is when I look back at a guy like Bob Knight and I look back at the coaches that I played for, was he that different than a lot of coaches now? When you see coaches in football on the sideline after a bad play or a bad penalty, and you see coaches screaming at players, and from a distance, if you've never been that player or if you've never been involved with sports on any level, from a distance you might look at that and say, that's just that. We don't need that. And yet, when you're the player on the receiving end, and you heard Cam Worrell talk about this earlier in the week, when you're a player on the receiving end, you understand what the message is. You understand why the message is being given to you in that manner. But where a Bob Knight crossed the line is when he would grab that student, when he choked that, he put his hand around that one student's neck and grabbed him. And he says in the last days of Knight, he says, I wanted that tape to come out. You know, with a lot of colorful language, you bet I wanted that tape to come out. His arrogance and his pride got in the way of reality, because the reality shows him choking the guy, the kid. I don't care if it was hard, if it was light, if it was just for a couple of seconds, the tape shows his hand on his neck. But that was how delusional he became. And more importantly, that was how big he thought he was in that program. And it reminds me of the way Joe Paterno was in his final days, final years, with the whole Jerry Sandusky thing, which is a whole different level. I understand that. But when you look at the way Paterno initially handled that, everything that came out, you know, in court, everything that was uncovered, no matter what you think of how forget about how the NCAA dealt with it. When you look at the way Paterno essentially brushed off what was going on and said, I let the President Spanier, I let them know about it. I let Schultz know about it. I let the right people know about it. It was the same mentality that Bob Knight had at Indiana, which was an unspoken, I'm bigger than this whole university. I can get away with whatever I need to get away with, because the only thing that matters is the success of this program, this athletic program. Are coaches today any different? They may not be choking students, thank goodness. They may not be throwing chairs across the court. They may not be bringing a bullwhip to campus. But is the power wielded by the Sabins, Myers, Harbaughs, Boeheims, Williams, Krzyzewskis, former UConn coach Jim Calhoun, is the power that they wield any different than Bob Knight? Absolutely not. It's the same. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up, bottom of the hour, Derek Carr. It is our encore of the week. Robert Kraft has come out and called Tom Brady the exact quote is definitely the greatest player of all time. He said he's definitely the greatest player of all time, not just quarterback, in my opinion, because he's such a leader in the locker room. For someone double the age of some of the players to be able to lead like that and connect like that and have the work ethic that he has, and at the same time so pleasant to be around, I'm really the luckiest guy in the world. I don't know. Is he the greatest player of all time? Said back in an interview a number of years ago, said that the Patriots really lucked out with Brady. I love the story that Kraft tells. He says, I think of him as this skinny young man coming down the steps of the old stadium with the pizza box and introducing himself to me. Kraft says, I said to him, I know who you are. You're Tom Brady from Michigan, our sixth-round draft choice. And then Kraft said that Brady responded to him, and I'm the best decision this organization has ever made. Yeah, he turned out to be right. But when you talk about the greatest player of all time, you start to get into that whole issue of Super Bowl championships versus, you know, looking at a player individually. You know, I throw this out there to you. Is he better than Joe Montana? Just in terms of as a player. Is he a better quarterback than Joe Montana, or better player, period? Is he better than Walter Payton? Was he better than Jerry Rice or Jim Brown? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm not the one to ask. Is he the greatest player to lead a team to Super Bowls? Obviously, he is. But is he the best player that I ever saw? If I was backed into a corner, you asked me who was a better quarterback, forget about the overall player, a better quarterback, maybe because I grew up with Joe Montana, I'd say Joe Montana. Montana was unbelievable in college at Notre Dame. I had the chance to be at his last regular season game in the Coliseum against USC. So it's hard to say. Do you look at Tom Brady as the greatest player of all time? Maybe some of you do. I'm not sure he is. Coming up, it's our weekly encore. Derek Carr is this week. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Final half hour, CGP for a Wednesday. Looks like a little bit of rain outside. We're full service here. If there's any way we can help your drive home, tell you about the weather. We can't really tell you about the traffic other than just saying there's probably a lot of cars out there. Probably crowded on 4199 and everywhere else. You know, we have a thing on this program where I feel like within every four-month period, we should have David and or Derek Carr on this program. It's just nice to check in, not only to find out what's going on, what they're doing off the field, because it's always a great amount of things they're doing off the field to help the community or to help Valley Children's, but to find out what Derek is doing with the Raiders. We know what he did during the season. And with that backdrop, we welcome number four in your program, former Fresno State star and now the quarterback of the Oakland Raiders, Derek Carr. Derek, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Hey, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of things I want to talk with you about. I want to talk about the Raiders, and I want to talk about John Gruden, Las Vegas, and a whole bunch of things. But I want to talk about the event first, and I'm going to be coming to it, and I can't wait. It's Inside the Huddle. I had Todd Sunterpeck on a few weeks ago, but it's fun to have you on. Tell folks what Inside the Huddle is that you and your brother David will be doing on March 2nd.
Yeah, so Inside the Huddle is a good way for basically my brother and I to help raise money for Valley Children's Hospital, you know, in a grand scheme. But we do it in a cool way where, you know, we get some film. We break some film down to show people the intricacies like of football. And we go to about, I don't know, David will probably tell you fifth grade. I'll tell you we go to about seventh grade football knowledge when it comes to breaking stuff down. Just for all the even if you wrote a bad tweet about me, about a throw, we would love for you to come and ask a question because we'll answer it very politely. No, we just like to break film down and do it in a fun way, teach some people some things, but then really at the end of the day, just interact with our community. And it's just, we know we can talk about a few things, our faith, our family, and we know a little bit about football, so we like to talk about that too. So we like to have fun with it. We have a great time. But, you know, we've done it different venues all, you know, throughout the years, but this year was really special because we get to do it at a special place this time.
Well, I think you and David should devote a segment just to reading angry tweets, because I could spend a whole show doing that. I probably have a lot more than you have. And I want to tell folks what this is, because there's only going to be 100 tickets sold this year. I'm going to put the phone number out. I'll give the phone number now. It's 877-353-0000. I'll put that out on Twitter a little bit later. But it's going to be very intimate this year. It's going to be up at Valley Children's. Tickets are $400, but there's going to be a gift bag. There's going to be a cool Raiders football in it. There's going to be a photo of you. There's going to be other little goodies in there. There's going to be hors d'oeuvres, an open bar. And Derek, just, you know, I've had you and your brother on the show at the same time. I've had David on the program live at Game Day Live, as well as at the Las Vegas Bowl. And I'm just guessing, let's talk about you right now, being the starting quarterback for the Raiders. You're in the national limelight. You're always a headline for, I mean, I'm sure you feel like for better or for worse, you're always going to be a headline. This is a chance for you and your brother to just kick back, have a beverage, and just shoot the breeze with fans that, you know, to remind folks that not only are you a regular guy, and your brother is too, but you have the same concerns for kids, for your own kids, for families that they have.
You know what, you're exactly right. And so, you know, when we're winning, everyone, you know, obviously has a lot to say about our team. And when we're losing or moving to a new city, there's a lot to say about our team. So, you know, there's always those kind of things. But at the end of the day, me and my brother, we're just human, you know. We're just two Valley kids that made it to the NFL and made good careers for ourselves. And, you know, at the end of the day, we just want to sit there and share with people our concerns also, you know, for our children's health. You know, I've both my brother and I have dealt with our own children being in too many hospitals to count, you know, surgeries here or finger pricks here, or, you know, whatever you want to think of. We've dealt with it. And so it's our time to, you know, be able to raise money for other families that need it, other families, you know, that desperately need children's health and things like that, you know, for their kids. And so just healthcare in general, but specifically being for the kids, man, because that's near and dear to our hearts, you know. And so we get to sit there and do it in Valley Children's Hospital, which is a great, great thing for us because, you know, I think it's important for everyone to see and be in the place exactly where all that money's going to go. And I think that that's, you know, number one is, you know, we want to show people, like, when they walk in the hospital, like, this is where it's going. You know, when you see, you know, a little kid walking through the halls, you know, that just had maybe a surgery or maybe is battling cancer or maybe just got in an accident, you know, you never know what it is. You know, there's stories all throughout those hallways. And if there's maybe one interaction that could change somebody's life and help out a family, then we want to be there and be able to, you know, bring forth some attention to that.
When we had, of course, my guest, folks, is Derek Carr, number four in your program, Oakland Raiders quarterback, former Fresno State star. When we had Todd Sunterbeck on the program a few weeks ago, of course, he's the president, CEO of Valley Children's. I asked him, you know, what kind of amount of money that's going to be raised on this particular night on March 2nd, how does that fare for what the operating costs are at the hospital? And he totally knocked me over when he said that it costs, and I believe I'm getting the number right, Derek, $2 million a day to run Valley Children's. And when you look at that number based upon, and then relative to what you and David are going to be raising that night, you're going to be raising a lot of money that night, but that still is a drop in the bucket. And that's why, going back to the birth of your son, Dallas, you also started DC, the number four, DC for Kids. How is that going?
Yeah, it's been awesome, man. We started that fund, just other ways for people to give, fans, you know, of myself or my brother, things like that. It's just another way for people to give. And we do that. We do touchdown challenges where people you know, fork over money for every touchdown that we get. You know, we just have fun with it, you know, just being able to have our platform and be able to raise money for things that actually matter, you know, besides football games. You know, it's really cool. And so, you know, it's just it's going to be a special deal to be able to help. You know, like you said, it costs a lot of money to run that place. It really does. And, you know, we've given money, you know, we've given money back, you know, to Valley Children's, and we do anything and everything that we can with our platforms to help them. Because at the same time, we know it's a lot of money sometimes to run that place. But if you were to tell me that that place would be there for my son and give him the three surgeries that he needed, you know, I would give up every cent that I have, like, in my account. So it's not even it's a no-brainer for us to bring attention and hopefully get some people to help out as well.
Well, there's no question about it, and I think it's a great thing that you have with DC for Kids, as well as this event, Inside the Huddle. Just a personal comment. I think that it's very easy when we look at the National Football League. We'll just leave it to the National Football League. We'll leave the other sports out of it. We look at the money that's being made. We look at the pros and cons. We look at all the issues and what have you. And I think, Derek, and you can speak to this, I think sometimes what the rank and file with those of us who aren't in the National Football League, what's easy to forget is that you and your teammates and everybody who has families, and even if you don't have kids yet or a spouse, have the same problems that everybody else has. And everybody has been touched by an illness with their own child, or maybe with a grandchild, or with a nephew or a niece or a grandson or a granddaughter. And that's why I think an evening like Inside the Huddle is so special, because not only did they get a chance to meet you and David, and they get to learn a little bit more about, you know, why you're so heavily involved with Valley Children's, but I think the very nature, Derek, of coming up to Valley Children's, it sort of solidifies or cements the need for evenings like this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, I think you hit it on the head. You know, I think everyone has dealt with something. You know, it's life, man. Life happens to everybody. It doesn't, you know, discriminate in any way. And so life happens. And when you have a beautiful place like Valley Children's that really is first class and, you know, takes care of, you know, the people and patients that are there and the families that are there going through things, you know, it's just a place that you want to back. It's just a place that you want to support. So, you know, like I said, even if you're not a Raider fan, even if you don't like my brother and I, you know, at least come out and just give some money to Valley Children's.
Even more reason. If somebody doesn't like you, even more reason to come up and then watch you break down some film. And then they can tell you why they know the game of football better than you, and we can all have a good laugh out of that. Folks, it's March 2nd, and it's Inside the Huddle. It's at Valley Children's Hospital. If you want to purchase tickets, and I hope that you do, there's only going to be 100 of them. The number you call, and again, I'm going to put this out on Twitter in a little while. The number you call is 877-353-0000. And the doors will open at 4:30. The evening starts at 5. There's going to be hors d'oeuvres. There's going to be an open bar, beer and wine. And there's going to be a drawing. Everybody coming in is going to get a raffle ticket. And Derek is going to call up a couple of people, and each one's going to receive a signed number 4 jersey. That is pretty darn cool. All right. We'll close in a few minutes with that again. But I can't have you on this program without talking about your team, the Oakland Raiders.
That's right.
You have, let's start with this. You have first round draft picks at 4, 24, and 27. If Derek Carr was sitting in the Raiders draft room, and maybe you will be, what's your wish list, Derek?
Yeah, man. You know, maybe someday I'll be sitting in the draft room. We'll see. You know, we need some guys that can come in and help us now. We have some good building pieces, we have some foundational pieces. You know, obviously we have a quarterback, so we don't need one of those. That's a good thing. And we just need some players that can come in and help us now. You know, we want to win now. We're building this thing. We've been building this thing. We've built this thing a couple of times. I think it's time to get some people that can just come in and help us now. You know, there's a lot of veterans on this team that, you know, signed contracts or signed extensions or signed free agent deals to come play here because we want to win now and believe in this this system, and we believe in what we're doing. And so I think if we get 3 players that are ready to play NFL ready now. And I think if you can do that, get 3 starters out of those 3 picks, and even 4 starters if you count, you know, some of the other picks. You know, if you can get that, some impact players, and then, you know, we have a lot of cash to spend. We got a lot of cap room And so I think if we can spend that cap and spend that capital to get some good talent, some good veteran players that just aren't just average players, but some guys that can come in and make a difference, we're a lot closer than people give us credit for.
How frustrating was it for you, Derek, to see Amari Cooper leave and then do so well with the Cowboys?
You know, I wasn't frustrated. You know, I was happy for him.
Okay.
You know, he started, playing at a high level. And, like I said 100 times before, and I'll say it again, I think Amari is a Hall of Fame player. As long as he continues to work and keeps working and works his tail off, he's a Hall of Fame type talent. And so some of the things that happened here, he got traded, I don't make those decisions, but, they saw something, in him that they said, hey, we're going to trade him and things like that. And then he went and had a fantastic year. And I still talk to Coop. Coop's one of my friends. Coop is someone that I'd have to my house. And, he would come and play basketball. And so Coop and I are friends. There's no problem there. We had a great time. He went to, his, first couple Pro Bowls, whatever it was, here playing with me. And we had some good memories. And then we had some hard times, And I think, Coop will be the first one to not tell you because he doesn't talk much. But he was playing hurt, a lot. He was banged up, and it looks like he finally got healthy. He was, finishing all his routes. He was playing hard, without the ball in his hands. And those are the kind of things that if he continues to do those, man, he's going to have a Hall of Fame career.
My guest is Derek Carr, quarterback of the Oakland Raiders. A couple more minutes with Derek, and then we'll give you all the details again of the event inside the huddle up at Valley Children's. John Gruden, he, like every coach, he has a system. Takes a while to learn that system, for everybody to get on the same page, and then to execute it for the best possible results. Derek, how long was it before you personally felt comfortable working within his system? And the second part of that is, how much more explosive do you believe this offense under your direction can be?
Oh, man. That's a great question with a very big answer. I mean, first it took me months to, master his system. And he told me, he would tell everybody I mastered it before he did, that guy. He likes to give me a lot of credit. But, he's a very smart coach, and I'm grateful and thankful that he came back to coach me and that I get to have the same coach for 2 years in a row. That's kind of nice. And he's a genius, offensive genius. He's a guy that, loves working with veteran players. He loves, coaching us hard and, having our backs at the same time. And under Coach Gruden last year, nobody wants to, talk about it, but we did some things on offense that have never been done. We did some things that I've never done in my career. I think I had career high in, in yards per attempt, yards, completion percentage, a whole bunch of different things, passes over 20 yards and passes over 40 yards, even though we checked the ball down, quote unquote, a lot. we broke some career highs that even in the 2016 season we didn't even do. So we're right back where we need to be, throwing the ball. Obviously, we're going to continue to get even better because that's only 1 year in a system. That's not even 12 months. And so now that we have a full year under our belt, we'll have two full off seasons together. I really believe that we can do some special things together.
What do you see, Derek, as a benefit with Mike Mayock as GM now in the Raiders system?
Oh, man. Mike is such a great guy. He called me. We had a great conversation for about 20 minutes, I think it was, 15, 20 minutes or whatever. And I'll be meeting, getting together with him soon and doing some more stuff. But, whenever we can do that, time allowed wise. And, we talked on the phone and, he's such a great guy. First of all, he's an amazing guy to talk to. He's very smart. He knows what he's doing. And just with him in the building, he's going to grind on tape and on film, till all hours of the night. And that's all you can ask for, man, is someone that just grinds, someone that just works hard. People can say whatever they want, but they can't question how hard that man works. So anyone who knows him and has been around him, at the NFL Network or things like that, knows that this man grinds and cares a lot about evaluating and, finding talent. So I think he's going to help us a lot, to be honest with you.
Derek, you came out and you put a plug in for one final year for games being played at Fresno State. I will be very transparent with you, and I said that I don't see that happening. But with 1 year to go before the move to Las Vegas, where do you realistically believe that the team is going to play their games in 2019?
Oh, man, that is a tough question. I don't have a guess on realistically where I think we're going to play. Where I hope we play is Fresno.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Come play at Bulldog Stadium. We got enough seats. We got more seats than the StubHub Center. We got suites. We got a field. We got a nice field turf. They don't have to do the fields over every all the time. You know, we got some nice stuff. We got enough stuff to, you know, house an NFL team, that's for sure, in Fresno. But, you know, I honestly hope it's one more year in Oakland. You know, I've heard San Francisco, you know, anywhere in the Bay Area is up for grabs, you know, because you don't want to, you know, relocate the team 2 years in a row. And so right. Anywhere in the Bay, I would assume, is up for grabs. But my hope, you know, if I can't have Fresno, is definitely to be at the Coliseum again, because we need to give our fans one more ride.
Last thing for you, going back to 2014, these are the records of the Oakland Raiders from 2014 on. 3-13, 7-9, and then a great season in 2016, 12-4, 6-10, and this past year, 4-12. In that time, you've thrown for nearly 19,000 yards. You've certainly done quite a bit. You've been nicked up here and there. What is it, as you look at this, whether it's getting a few more pieces, as you were mentioning, what is it that you believe is going to be able to turn this franchise around? If there was one singular thing, that's redundant, that can turn this franchise around to being more like 2016, what is it, Derek?
Ooh, winning.
Yeah.
The simple answer is winning. You know, I think it's just consistency. You know, every position, every coach, every scout, you know, every staff member, just consistency every day. You know, we have to be the same people every day. You know, you can't flash here and then, you know, not show up for us one day, you know, in week four or week 12. You know, we got to just have the same guy all the time. And we know not everyone's perfect, but if we can just have consistency, you know, there's no doubt that we're going to be just fine. You know, we have the right coaching staff. Obviously, we dealt with a lot of injuries, you know, on our team, offensive line, receivers, running backs. We missed a lot of pieces, and we were still efficient. We were still able to play good football here and there, and we were still able to do some things. So if we can get even our group to just play more consistent, and it starts with me, we're going to be a pretty good football team.
He is Derek Carr, number four in your program. Of course, him and David are going to be hosting Inside the Huddle. It's going to be benefiting Valley Children's Healthcare, and it's going to be up at Valley Children's. It's a great event. It's going to be on March 2nd. Doors open at 4:30. The evening starts at 5. They're going to be breaking down film. They're going to be taking pictures. They're going to be talking to you. You're going to be getting goodies. You're going to eat. You're going to, you know, it's going to be a great night. If you want to go, and I insist that you go, here is the number to call, and as I said, I'm going to put it up on Twitter in just a second, 877-353-0000. Folks, the big winners in this are the kids and their families. The money that you are paying for a ticket, yeah, you get a great opportunity to see David Carr and Derek Carr, but more importantly, the kids and Valley Children's Healthcare, they're the big winners. Derek, I can't thank you enough. I know that you're always pulled in a bunch of different directions. Always appreciate talking with you. Best of luck. Enjoy your offseason, and best of luck in 2019. I'm sure we'll talk to you before then.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Derek Carr, real stand-up guy. I love having him on. One more thing is next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
8:05 Friday picks. Tony Landry, Big Ten This Morning producer, Sirius XM. That's coming your way. Urban Meyer is close to a deal to be a, well, he's got a choice here. It's a deal with Fox. They approached him. He did TV when he left Florida for a couple of years. Did a great job. He did a great job. Of course, he announced his retirement in December. Had listed health and some other factors that went into it, and we know the whole story. But he spent the 2011 season as a game analyst for ESPN, and then he went back to the sidelines at Ohio State. They're giving him his choice. Fox is giving him a choice to either be part of the studio or part of game coverage. Either way, Fox's number one game crew is Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt. Joel Joe Davis, excuse me, and Brady Quinn are the number two team, I would, Joel Klatt does a better job on TV than I think he does on Twitter. That's just my personal opinion. But he is a former, he's a former Colorado quarterback, but he does a good job. But I think Urban Meyer would be a better choice. I think, and plus, him and Gus Johnson would definitely be sort of the yin and yang. You see Urban Meyer, and my first thought goes to how long is he going to be in TV? Because I get the health concern. There's no question. I buy it. I understand it. You can see him. You saw him on the sideline doing everything he could do to try to keep his emotions in check because of everything that was going on with his health. But as a guy who's in his mid to late 50s and who has been so successful, I've got to believe a year or two recharging, relaxing, getting healthy, he's going to be back on the sideline somewhere. But where do you go? You know, where does a guy like Urban Meyer go if he decides to coach again? You look at his trajectory and the last two jobs, winning a couple of national championships at Florida and having a Heisman Trophy winner there, going to Ohio State, winning a national championship there. That's where he's from. He's an Ohio kid. Where does he go from there? Does he go back to the SEC if there's a job open? He's probably not going to go anywhere else in the Big Ten. Unlikely. The school that's thrown out there a lot is USC, but I think people are thinking about that maybe in the wrong way. I could see that maybe next year, but I don't think he's going to be ready to coach next year. Maybe I'll talk with Tony Landry about that, see what he thinks, because he talks about the Big Ten every single day. Tony Landry coming up. This is the CGP.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP for a Friday morning, begins right now. 3 minutes, 41 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Glad to have you aboard. Christopher Gabriel in the A chair. Russ keeping the program going in the right direction. And from here on the West Coast, we go approximately 3,000 miles east to the city of Washington, D.C., where we check in with our very good friend, the producer of Big Ten This Morning for SiriusXM. It's Channel 372 on your scorecard, Mr. Tony Landry. Good morning to you, Tony.
And a good morning to you and all of those in the lovely, balmy Northern California Valley.
Yes, it's lovely. It is lovely today. The sun is out. The sun has not been out a lot lately. You know, we get about a month and a half of rain and overcast, and then it's basically the Sahara for the rest of the year.
Well, could be worse. I had all great ideas today. I was going to go check out Georgetown, the neighborhood. I haven't really been over there much. I wanted to go see it. It's 31 and lightly snowing. So starting to think it's me.
It could be.
It's just wherever I go. The desolate, you know, the North remembers follows me.
Well, you know, I looked on my little weather app this morning, and I've got a number of cities that are bookmarked on there, and I noticed that when I was driving in this morning at about 6:30 a.m., the temperature in your former hometown and my former hometown, Fargo, North Dakota, zero, and the temperature is going to go lower as the day goes on.
The great joys of living in a Midwestern city, when the sun comes out, the temperature actually finds a way to drop. I was talking to my parents who are actually leaving for Florida in a couple of days, and the high temperature in Grand Forks, North Dakota, for your listeners, on Saturday is 25 degrees below zero.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because
I can hear Russ crying right now.
Yeah. you know, you think about – I've had people ask me, can you feel the difference between, say, zero and 25 below yes, you can. Yes, you can. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think once you get to, once there's a negative in front of the number, it's just you're so angry and cold that there's you've lost sense and feeling at that point. It's when little old women in Target start giving you the middle finger for no reason.
Yeah, you hit the right word because it's weird how you do get angry in that kind of cold weather. And I'm not sure, it's almost borderline irrational getting angry at the weather, but you do. I remember a couple of times standing in the middle of a street near downtown Fargo, and it was about 17, 18 below. The wind chill was in the 30 below range. And just standing there thinking, my goodness, what am I doing here? I love the city, but it was just brutal. You know, your eyes are watering. Your face is freezing off. Your eyebrows are frozen. I mean, it's just things are falling apart around you. Cars are sliding off the road, and you're just wondering, what are we doing? What are we doing here?
Why is this a thing, and who decided to stop here?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is Friday, and it's Friday Picks, and you know what that means. Yeah. Last week, Tony, you went 2-2. I went 1-3. You did very well. You picked up a game. You are now 92-52-2. You're only four behind. I'm 96-48-2. You've got time. You've got time. I don't know. I feel like I'm the team that's not able to close out the game.
I'm trying to think of what the sports analogy for the team that's like the middle of his career, Aaron Rodgers. A lot of 13-3s with no Super Bowls.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And so we've got four games that we're going to pick for our friends this week. Obviously, Patriots at Chiefs, Rams at Saints, and we will also give folks one college pick, number four, Virginia, going into number one. I don't know if Duke is still number one, but it's a great matchup. It's going to be in Cameron on Saturday. And then Sunday in Staples Center, the Lakers are hosting the Golden State Warriors. I don't think that LeBron's going to be back yet, but it's an intriguing matchup. Let us begin with Patriots at Chiefs. We did some analysis on the program yesterday, lots of things in play with this game. You look at Tom Brady and the stat that I threw out yesterday, 28-10 all time in the playoffs. But interestingly enough, on the road, he's 3-4. Mr. Landry, how do you see this game?
Yeah, I want this to be the game everyone thinks it's going to be. I want this to be 31-28, and it's a final touchdown or field goal or something that gets us to the end result at which we got to. It's the young up-and-coming gunslinging Patrick Mahomes that's going to change football. And everyone, we've talked about it all year, how now if you can, you know, kiss the cloth that is Sean McVay, your next coach will be fantastic. Well, apparently if you can have somebody emulate or be Patrick Mahomes, you now are, you know, that's the new benchmark in football. But the problem is the old benchmark, number 12, still exists. And it's one of those things that, you know, there's death, there's taxes, and there's Brady and Belichick. It's hard to pick against immortality. It's hard to go and say the dynasty is over and it's time to move on. But then you remember who they are. It's too easy to not pick them. Like everybody, I'm sure on TV, it'll be the talking heads of the world. Half the panel will be Chiefs fans, and this is where it finally happens. Well, until it finally happens, I'm always taking Brady and Belichick. I'm going with the Pats on this one.
I thought you were going to play the Brian Billick card for a second.
I mean, I used to put Brian on hold all the time in Minneapolis, so apparently he's rattling around in my subconscious.
Is there any one? There probably are, but when I think of Brian Billick, I had him on the show one time, not here, but back in Fargo. It was prior to you joining me, and I was worried moment to moment what he was going to say. Did you ever get that feeling when you've had him on?
Yeah, and what's weird about him is I think he's either of genius level or he's a member of Mensa level intelligence, too.
You're right.
So
yeah, he is.
He, like, at any point in time, he could be breaking down, like, theories and, you know, wind velocity and then just obscure things that no one ever thought would be coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, when he makes a transition to talking about Greenland and the Arctic Circle and combining weather in the at the North Pole or at the South Pole in Antarctica, you know, versus, you know, then and running a compare and contrast with game day conditions in Baltimore, he's lost me. And he did that once.
Yeah.
And he completely lost me.
It's kind of like if you took the drugs away from Bill Walton. You never really know what's going to happen.
Well, you know, you just I feel for his broadcast partner because the last time I heard Walton, Walton was saying, you know, have you ever just gotten the urge to just run around outside naked? And I just thought, wow, where do you, you know, you're sitting at half court calling a Pac-12 game. Where do you go with that?
Yeah, and like poor Sean McDonough's got to be like, and Phillips for three.
Yes,
why?
Exactly.
Why?
This game, boy, your thoughts on New England are spot on. I think it's hard to ever pick against them, and that's why I'm going to pick against them. I think,
yes.
I'm going to go against them because I do think that there is something to be said for a team that has a guy playing as well as Patrick Mahomes. That offense has clicked all year long. He has, and I said this yesterday, Tony, Patrick Mahomes has shown that there has been no stage, no stadium that he's gone to, no opponent, no defense that has been bigger than he's been. In terms of the moment, it's not been bigger for him to be able to handle. I made the same example with Trevor Lawrence going into the national championship game, going up against previously vaunted Alabama. I think that Kansas City at home is a different animal. I think New England, they can win anywhere. It's interesting that they haven't done great on the road in the playoffs behind Brady. I mean, they've done everything else. But I do think there are a couple of places in this league that are difficult to go in and win. It's going to be interesting to see the weather conditions and the fact that Kansas City at Arrowhead, they have re-sodded the field. They said the field, I saw a picture of it. It looks good. But you and I both know that when you resod a field, and depending upon what happens with the weather, it's going to be in the 20s. How is that going to affect the play? Is it going to affect a Sony Michel? Is it going to affect Patrick Mahomes in any way? I like the Chiefs in this game. I do believe that they're going to find a way to knock out Tom Brady, and I think it's going to be close. I think it's going to probably be in the 30s. And I don't know, what is the over, just out of curiosity, what is the over-under on this game?
I'll have to look. The last time I saw it, it was a number that I was actually kind of surprised by. But as we, I'll take a look here as we're.
It was in the 50s, wasn't it? Somewhere.
I want to see. Yeah, it was in the 50s. But let me let's see here.
Because I'm inclined to whatever that number is. If it is in the 50s, if I was a betting man and I'm not, I would be inclined to take the over. Because I
was going to say, I thought it was 53, and it's currently 55 and a half.
Yeah, I would, I don't know about you, I would go with the over because I just don't, if there's one thing that doesn't scare me, it's the Patriots defense. And quite frankly, neither does the Kansas City defense. I think that this game is going to be won or lost behind Patrick Mahomes or Tom Brady. You know what you're going to get with Brady. Last year in the Super Bowl, Nick Foles goes off for nearly 400 yards. All Brady does is throw for 505 yards, and they still nearly win that game, which, you know, makes me start to question my pick for this weekend's game. But I am going to stick with Kansas City, Tony.
Yeah, you look at it, it opened at 58. It's bet down to 55.5, and it's currently Kansas City -3, which those of you that know a little bit about sports gambling, you get 3 points for being the home team. So Las Vegas is pretty much telling you, yeah, it's going to go either way. We have no idea. But 60% of the money right now coming in on the over. So I would agree. You have two defenses that they're not quite at the Big 12 level, but they're not exactly the 85 Bears either.
Well, that's a very good point. We're talking with Tony Landry. It's Friday Picks. Tony, of course, producer of Big Ten this morning out in Washington, D.C. at SiriusXM, does a tremendous job for them. All right, Rams at Saints. This is the third time that they have played this year. They also played in the preseason. Saints have won both of these. Of course, their earlier game, the game they played in the regular season, the game that actually counted, you know, they combined for, what, 80 points, 970 yards. And one piece of this game, again, that I talked about yesterday that I wanted to throw at you that I think is notable is the absence of Sheldon Rankins in this game. We'll see how that affects the run defense of the Saints. The Rams finished the season as the NFL's third best rushing team. Of course, they ran wild on the Cowboys, 273 yards. And they also have a kicker who has attempted 6 field goals over 50 yards, second most in the NFL. I always mess up his pronunciation, Greg Zuerlein or Zuerlein. I want to say it's Zuerlein.
Greg Zuerlein, yep.
Yeah. And I think
like
that...
Like the steak, kind of.
Yeah, or maybe Steve Berline. I think that that's something that could end up being a factor in this game. Tony, how do you see it?
This one's going to be interesting. It's, you know, since I still have the info up, this is a game that opened at 57 points. 56.5 is where it currently sits. Both of these teams, are, when you think about it, they're high-powered offenses or what everybody remembers. The New Orleans Saints defense has been really something a lot of people didn't see coming in the last few weeks. When was the last time you thought about the vaunted New Orleans Saints defense? It's, you know, the last defensive starter I could probably name from them was Jonathan Vilma, and
yeah,
he retired over a decade ago. So it's one of those things where if you can find a way to shut down either of these offenses with defenses, or at least maybe get the points off of that, because I don't think either of these offenses, when they get rolling, are going to be able to be shut down. You look at either side of the ball, I mean, look at the running back matchups we're going to get in this game with Gurley, Elvin Kamara, who I don't know if you saw on Twitter today, is up picking up garbage in New Orleans.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah,
I'm not really sure why he's not at practice, but hey, to you, it seems like a really cool thing you're doing. So I'm happy for you. I think this one comes down to the, you know, kind of like the last game we talked about. You have an MVP, you have a Super Bowl winning quarterback against the, you know, the second wave coming up with Jared Goff. It'll come down to what quarterback doesn't turn the ball over. In a betting term, I would bet the over on 56.5. I know that's a big number, but these are teams that can score big points. I think this comes down to the fact that this is in New Orleans. If this was in L.A., it would be a different situation because you'd get a little blend of both. You'd have some New Orleans fans there. You'd have some L.A. Rams fans. It would be interesting. The fact that this is being played in the Bayou makes this a whole different ballgame for me. I'm going with Drew Brees and the Saints.
Outstanding analysis, and again, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going with the Rams in this game. I think that one addition that the Rams have this time around that they didn't have going up against Drew Brees the first time is Aqib Talib. And I think that even though this is a guy who is not an interception machine, I think this is a guy that's going to at least create some problems for Brees and that passing attack. Alvin Kamara going back to week 9 on the New Orleans side, he is, you know, a former Tennessee running back who Butch Jones thought so highly of that he kept him on the bench most of the time. Is Butch still an intern at Alabama? I think he is.
I think he's still getting coffees.
Yeah, I looked for him at Media Day in San Jose, and I didn't see him. Strangely enough, he was not one of the featured assistant coaches. But Kamara is terrific. He had 82 yards and a couple of touchdowns back in Week 9. He had 34 yards. He caught 4 passes for 34 yards and a touchdown. Overall, he had 116 total yards, 3 touchdowns. Kamara is just a tremendous football player. I've got to tell you, I really like the fact that I think the Rams very easily could have won that game earlier this year. I think the Rams and the Saints are both a little better than they were when they met in Week 9. I just don't think this team is going to beat the Rams for a third time, preseason, regular season, playoffs. I don't think it's happening. And
that's a good point.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, and will it surprise me, Tony, if the Saints win this game in a high scoring shootout? No, absolutely not. But I'm going to go the other way, and I think also that adds intrigue, you know, for you and I. I mean, let's just call it what it is.
Certainly.
You know, there's a little.
One of us is making up ground this week.
That's right, exactly. Let us move to Virginia at Duke. This is going to be a great game in Cameron Indoor. A sidebar to this story, and it really means nothing to the extent of who's going to win. Or maybe it does a little bit. I am not a fan of the whole Cameron crazy thing. I'm just not. I think that about 20 years ago they were pretty interesting. But they've become a character of themselves, and I really get tired of hearing Dick Vitale Vitale talk about them as though we all need to just bow in the direction of Durham, North Carolina. That aside, Duke has some remarkable talent on this basketball team. Virginia's defense is as good as anything you're going to see in all of college basketball. Duke is a tough place to go into, but if there's anybody that can go in there and win this game, I mean, besides their tremendous defense, nobody's really scoring against Virginia. I think Virginia's got enough offense to go in there and beat them. I'm not going to play the card that says if Syracuse can go in and win, so can Virginia. But Virginia is a team that has won there before, and I think they go into Duke, and I think they win.
Yeah, Tony Bennett has a hell of a squad at Virginia. Every year in and year out, it's what he does. He puts up good teams. It's one of those things, like, if you're not a diehard college basketball person, like, you might turn on TV and see, like, oh, Virginia's got a good basketball team. How about that? Like, I work for the Big Ten Network and just recently saw that Maryland had cracked the top 25. When was the last time Maryland, you know, had made that kind of a bold move their way up? But now they're doing that. And it's one of those things where it would not surprise me one bit if they won. I think the health issues that Duke currently has, with about half their freshman starters being hurt.
Trey Jones especially, the separated shoulder.
Trey Jones, yeah, Zion Williamson being banged up already. You know, you've got some questions around these kids that's going to make it interesting to see where they can go. But at the end of the day, they're Duke. They're, you know, they are the original blue bloods of, you know, not really knowing what you're going to get out of a team. And then, hey, what do you know? Something named Alex O'Connell decided to go off and drop 45 on somebody. So I'm going to go with Duke in this one, and it's not that it pains me, but I came very close to thinking this could be a very easy, not easy, a very winnable game for Virginia.
I think you make one point that's in particular outstanding, and that is that Duke over the years has always had that ability, as you just mentioned. Somebody comes up off the bench, nobody knows who he is, and he drops 45. And it's a reminder of how much depth Krzyzewski is able to have on his bench every single year. He's got guys, I mean, his whole bench, except for a walk-on or two that usually pops on there, his whole bench are former All-Americans or McDonald's All-Americans, and you just don't know what's going to happen. But I do think, I liked what you did there saying the blue bloods. I liked the little play on the blue. That was very impressive how you sort of rolled that out.
Every once in a while, my brain, even though I get up this early, still works.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure if Cam Reddish is going to be playing. Is he still out? I'm not sure. But I guess he's returned to practice. But it's a tough place to play. But Virginia, you know, they're undefeated. There's a lot of things on the board that would suggest here comes the big upset. And is it really that much of an upset when Duke's playing at home in front of a raucous crowd? But if there isn't really a team in the ACC that's ever intimidated going into Cameron Indoor, so I'm gonna stick with my UVA. Finally, it seems like a mismatch, but you never know, because the Warriors have certainly looked a little odd at times this year. Of course, they had we'll go ahead and say it was something of a statement win over Denver the other night, blowing them out with their 51-point first quarter. They're not going to call it a statement win, but I think that's what it was. The Lakers are a much tougher team, obviously, with LeBron James. But they've had a couple of good wins lately. LeBron is sooner or later is going to get back. This is a fun matchup at Staples Center on Monday night. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it'd be a little different if LeBron was healthy or completely playing, you know, in 100% mode, but Boogie Cousins comes back this weekend. I think people have kind of forgot he plays for the Golden State Warriors. It's going to take a game or two for him to kind of acclimate fully into that system, where he's going to look and go, okay, I'm wide open. Why are these guys shooting from 41 feet away? But at no point is he – I say that knowing what he could bring to a locker room. I think when you add a great inside presence, a rim protector, shot blocker, somebody to pick up all the rebounds from – you know, the three-pointers that don't go in for Golden State, and it could get silly and unfair once they kind of get rolling into early spring here. I got to be honest, the Lakers without LeBron James are about as fun right now as the Cavs without LeBron James. It's a who's who of cast-offs and young players that haven't fully developed yet, and there is some talent on that team. You know, Brandon Ingram is really good. Lonzo Ball has his moments. There's, you know, some savvy veterans, but when you take him off that team, they are not very good. And last check, the Golden State Warriors are the elite of the elite in the NBA. I'm taking Golden State, and I'm taking them by as many points as I could physically take.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one completely. I think that there is a I've had a chance to watch the Lakers a number of times this year, and with LeBron, I mean, they had gotten up to the number 4 seed. They're sitting at number 9 right now. When LeBron comes back, they were playing at a 585 clip. They were on pace to win somewhere 48, 49 games. I predicted 50 before the season started. I think that they can still get to that point, somewhere between 45 and 50. They're going to make the playoffs, and they might very well surprise somebody in the first round. They're going to be better in year 2 or year 3 of LeBron, but they're not there yet, and without LeBron, assuming it's without LeBron on Monday night, Lonzo Ball and company, they're just, you know, they'll be competitive for a while, but Golden State's going in there understanding that, you know, there is this idea that this is the marquee matchup. Well, it's marquee in franchise name only right now. I like Golden State in this game. I think that Klay Thompson and Steph Curry are just going to light their guards up, and they're going to go off in this game. So we are the same on one game, and the other three we are not. There will be movement. Either I will go a little bit further up the food chain, or you and I will suddenly be within one game of each other, and then we'll have a Super Bowl and another game to kind of finish out the Friday picks to see where we're at. A lot of excitement. I think most listeners are probably going to be on pins and needles this weekend, not for the games, but for you and I.
I'm losing sleep over this, my man. I thought with my penchant for gambling, I'd have ran away with this thing a long time ago, but you are proving to be more than a formidable opponent. So yeah. A tip of the cap to you all the way here from the great city that is the district.
Yeah, it's very kind of you. It's the first year I've had that's a good year in like 10 years. Tony Landry, he is the producer of Big Ten This Morning, SiriusXM. Thank you, my friend. Have a great weekend.
You too, sir. Always great to be on the CGP.
All right. It is the CGP.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
We always like to close our week on a very high note. That means we bring in one of the best in the business, Nick Shager, Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, and goodness knows how many other publications. Happy Friday to you, my friend. Welcome aboard.
Happy Friday. Good to speak with you.
We have not talked about 30 for 30 for a while, so I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about your Celtics at some point, and the fact that, am I right, this doesn't look to be a great weekend of films.
No, it's a weekend with one big movie and a few others that are basically opening wide, but came out at the end of last year hoping for awards attention, which I think they're going to get. But really, there's only one big ticket, which I'm sure we're going to get to in a little bit.
A friend of mine who's a movie critic in Minneapolis and St. Paul used to call a weekend like this. He would put it in print, and he would call it a WEAK, a weekend that way, which is really, I guess, fitting. You know, the reason I wanted to mention 30 for 30 with you is the last days of night, Heather Dinich, who is a wonderful writer. She graduated from Indiana University a number of years ago, but she's a terrific writer on college football, college basketball. And she was one of the people who's featured in The Last Days of Night, which premiered back on November 29th on ESPN. And she was one of the couple of journalism students at Indiana that essentially got an exclusive sitting on the back porch of Knight's house with him, and they had 2 days of interviews. They ran tape and what have you. And what's interesting that's brought up about him, and I talked about this in the first half hour of the program, is how coaches like Bob Knight, I don't think that he's that different than a lot of the ones today. The only difference is that today, and this is what 30 for 30 at least gives you subtext for, Nick, today the tolerance for those kinds of coaches has gone out the window But but they still exist. The guys out there that own their town and their campus, the Boeheims and Krzyzewskis, formerly Jim Calhoun or Nick Saban and Bobby Bowden when he was at Florida State, those guys still exist.
Oh, yeah, there are still titans like that. As you were talking, I was thinking about Nick Saban, of course, who is basically, you know, the mayor down there. And these guys do rule with an iron fist, I think, and it's certainly their way or the highway. And I don't think they're necessarily easy guys to, you know, get along with. I think they're really demanding. I think they're tough. I think they expect a lot more than the average coach does, which applied tonight, too, as I think the 30 for 30 showed. The difference is some of Knight's bad behavior was just too public. And in a way that a lot of these guys now know either A, to keep that under wraps, or B, to avoid it altogether, because we live in a different age. Cameras are always there. Athletes are more empowered to speak out, both to the media and on social media. You just can't sort of run an operation in the same way without bringing, you know, the world down upon your head. Now, Knight, I don't think, really cared, but he was from a different era. And I think 30 for 30 is the kind of show that really does get at a lot of these things in a way that, you know, your average sports documentary wouldn't, because ESPN has such access to both the principal players themselves, you know, the athletes, the coaches, the reporters, but it also has access to so much footage. And then it's being made by people who live and breathe and die sports. So you really get a really good micro view of a lot of different stories. And that's why the show has thrived, I think, because they do so many micro views of every little story that, you know, as a sports fan, you know. But, you know, they're able to bring a lot more insight into them.
Well, and that really is it, the insight and the depth, the nuance, because what they do in their documentaries is they give you the meat, but they also give you the side dishes and the dessert. They give you the backstory that you didn't know about. I always think about whatever I think about 30 for 30, the one that jumps to mind immediately is the two Escobars. You know, with Pablo Escobar, the drug cartel guy, and Andres Escobar, the great soccer player for Colombia, who you know, rather infamously scored that Colombia was favored in the 94 World Cup, and he had an own goal, and Colombia got eliminated, and tragically 2 weeks later he was assassinated in his car. He was gunned down. And right. What you learned, the thing that I didn't know, for all of the details of that I knew, and this is the genius, I think, of 30 for 30 that you just mentioned, is this strange dichotomy in Colombia at the time that 30 for 30 drew out, which was, for as ruthless a guy that Pablo Escobar was, he was also beloved by all those communities there, because he was, with drug money no less, he was building towns, he was giving people homes, he was putting up schools and libraries, and the people, the rank and file, loved him, even though the government wanted him out.
Yeah, I think 30 for 30, you know, in focusing on stories like that, can really get at the, not just the sports element of it, but the larger sort of sociological portrait of it. And I mean, that's a great example of where the show does that. You know, the greatest example, of course, is O.J. Made in America, which a couple of years ago was my number one film of the year because it was released in theaters before it was on ESPN. But there you had a real 7-hour, you know, miniseries, but done in the same style as 30 for 30. And it was a 30 for 30 production, where it's not just about O.J.'s athletic career. It's not just about the murders, obviously, but it's about all of those things intertwined with living in Los Angeles and those communities during the 70s, during the 80s, during the 90s, the relationship between the African-American community and the police community, the way the media had changed during that era, and all of that sort of combining to give you a much larger portrait than just, you know, a simple story about you know, OJ being great at USC or OJ being accused of these infamous murders. And so the show can sort of move in both directions. While you know, in most of its instances with the hour-long ones, really focusing in on something that you either know about and love or something that you didn't know about, and giving you greater perspective. And it's why the show continues to thrive. I mean, I think they've done over 100 of them now. So, yeah. You know, it really is a formula that works and continues to work for them.
Nick Shager is I would call him a guest, but he's a regular on this program, been a regular forever. He's the best critic out there, period. Let's just call him what it is. With Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Some movies opening up this weekend, mainstream films. One that's got me very intrigued right off the bat is Stan and Ollie, of course, talking about Laurel and Hardy. You've got a couple of wonderful actors in it. I was a big Laurel and Hardy fan growing up, and then I, much to my surprise, 20 years after probably the last time I had watched a Laurel and Hardy film, I learned a lot of the backstory. I'm assuming that this gets into that.
Yeah, Stan and Ollie came out in the fall. It came out actually right before the end of the year. And so as a result, it's opening wide now, but John C. Reilly, who is one of the two stars, John C. Reilly plays Hardy. Steve Coogan plays Stan Laurel. John C. Reilly's already been nominated for Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy at the Golden Globes. So he's in the awards mix, and rightfully so. As you correctly surmised, the film isn't about their entire career. It's really a story about the end of their career when they had fallen on hard times. The film picks up really sort of, you know, at the end of their great sort of partnership on screen, where things have fallen on hard times and things have sort of actually fallen apart between them because of a decision over a contract dispute where they didn't agree. And so Stan wound up working with another partner, which Oliver Hardy found to be a betrayal. Nonetheless, they try and mend fences to go on one big last tour, comedy tour across the country, to get funding for a new movie. And the tour is one of those, it leads to one of those stories where things start off rough and get better as they go along. But the story is really about their relationship. And it is surprisingly sweet and insightful without being overly nostalgic. And I have to say, both Coogan and Reilly are just fantastic in it. They really do nail the characters without just doing sort of straightforward impersonations. They do a great job redoing some of the bits. And at the end of the movie, there's actually a great sequence where it compares the two and you can see how well they did it. But the story really is about two characters and about two friends and how friendships get complicated, especially when you mix business in with them. I think people who are interested in Stan and Laurel Hardy, Laurel and Hardy, are going to be into it. I don't think it's going to be a magnificent hit here, but I do think it's a worthwhile film. It's one of those ones that's sort of slipping under the radar and people should keep an eye out for.
Will Glass be a big consensus hit? I always struggle pronouncing M. Night Shyamalan's. Is that
Shyamalan?
Shyamalan. Okay, I will watch anything that he puts out because there's always some unique, unusual twist to his product, his products, his productions. What are we getting with Glass this time around?
Well, Glass is definitely the big ticket item I was referring to before. It's going to be the big hit of the weekend. I think it'll probably be the big hit of the month because, you know, Shyamalan had all those big hits, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. You know, obviously The Sixth Sense was the big one and sort of turned him into the master of surprise twists. He fell on hard times his own career, and he'd had a number of duds until a few years ago when he made a small independent horror movie called The Visit. That then led him to make Split 2 years ago with James McAvoy as a man suffering from 20-some-odd multiple personalities who kidnaps three girls because he believes he has a secret multiple personality that's some sort of superhuman beast. And that film was an enormous hit. I thought it was a really great thriller. And at the very end of it, there's a big surprise twist, which reveals that it is actually a sequel to the movie Unbreakable, which Shyamalan made with Bruce Willis years ago, which was a superhero film. So here we get Glass because it brings together Unbreakable and Split in the big film. You've got Sam Jackson as Mr. Glass, the supervillain. Bruce Willis is the hero, and James McAvoy as the psychopath. And I have to admit, it's a letdown. I was very excited. I think a lot of people were after Split, which was so good. This film starts off really well, and then, you know, most of the film, as people will know because they've been showing it in every trailer and poster imaginable, the three of them wind up in a psychiatric hospital, and that's how they sort of come together. And unfortunately, once that starts happening in the film gets really small scale-wise, and rather than being a bigger film, since we're actually linking two universes together here into a bigger story, the film gets a lot more narrow, and I found that it didn't really approach the heights that you were expecting, and that definitely holds true in its second half when it never really builds up the momentum to a great climax that you've been waiting for, in which the movie is really sort of promising by its very existence. So I think people will not, you know, overly dislike it, but I do think most people are going to think that it's a bit of a missed opportunity. And I'll say, you know, Shyamalan made Split for very little money, and that was why it was such an enormously profitable hit. And he did the same thing here. It gives him greater creative control to make the movie for less money, and it obviously guarantees profits. But the problem is, in this movie, you can feel that he's done it. Mm. You can feel that he's cut down on locations, he's cut down on effects, he's cut down on set pieces to make it leaner and more efficient. But the problem is, this movie needed to be bigger. And you can feel that in the end.
Well, I want to deviate just for a second because you did throw in Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense. And I've never asked you this, but the surprise ending in that, once we understood what was going on and then we went back and looked at all the little scenes and what have you, then it all made sense. When you were watching it, for the first time, I don't know if you had advance notice of what was going on. Did you know what was happening, or did you have to wait till the end to get it?
Well, I have to admit, I'm the annoying guy who usually sees things in advance just because I've seen so many movies. And I actually did know about midway through the movie. I did guess the ending to it, but you know, I had to wait till the end to actually find out about it. It's funny because in general, as I've gotten older, I've tried to do that less while I watch movies. I try not to immediately guess the surprise, but my wife loves to do it more than anybody. So I'm still sunk on that front because we'll start watching a movie in 3 minutes and she'll point at the random character and go, "That's the bad guy." So, you know, that guessing game is fun, but, you know, luckily Shyamalan, I think, moved a little bit away from just turning his movies into guessing games.
Yeah, that's a good point. One more thing is coming up, and one more thing is going to be about If Beale Street Could Talk and Nick Shager's beloved Boston Celtics. We'll see what he, you know, he's very mercurial when we're talking about the Celtics. Good win here, bad loss there. We'll see where he's at. I've got a thought or two about them as well. This is the Friday CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for your Friday morning. Going into the weekend, hope you have some fun things planned. Don't forget Fresno State tomorrow, 2:30. Big game up in Boise, Idaho against the Broncos. Paul Leffler and Coach Q will have the call. We return to our friend Nick Shager. He is film critic at Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. If Beale Street Could Talk, we touched on this very briefly a while back, and now this is a big Oscar contender, and now we have some time to talk a little bit more about it. I like movies that are, I love period pieces, and this to me is very much a period piece, although it's unusual because it's not a period piece that is from the 1800s, but it, you know, which is where, you know, 1800s and set in London, but this is very much a period piece, and on the surface, it looks like a pretty cool production.
Yeah, it's a period piece that's set in the 70s in New York City, with obvious attempts to link its story to the present. It is the new movie from Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight, which won Best Picture at the Oscars a couple of years ago. So no surprise that If Beale Street Could Talk is in the Oscar mix. I think it's going to wind up, we're going to get nominations for the Oscars actually this coming week, and I think it's going to do pretty strongly in terms of nominations, although my guess is that the only Oscar it actually has a chance to win an award for is for Regina King for Best Supporting Actress. She plays the mother of one of the main characters, because the story is really about two young lovers in 1970s Harlem who wind up sort of both developing their relationship at the same time. We see them developing their relationship, and we also see them dealing with the fact that the man is accused of raping a Hispanic woman and winds up going to jail, even though he has been falsely accused of this crime. So the film is both a love story and a portrait of people trying to navigate the criminal justice system and people dealing with criminal injustice, let's say. It is a beautifully shot movie, extremely well directed, extremely well acted. To my mind, it left me a little bit cold. I wasn't quite as moved as I was by Moonlight. Moonlight really got to me on an emotional level, and for If Beale Street Could Talk, I found that Jenkins sort of strained a bit too much directorially. He tries a little too hard, both with his images and with his music, to get an emotional response. And when I feel like I'm being played a bit too strongly, I step back a little bit. So the movie doesn't 100% work for me, but it's certainly a handsome production. It certainly is an adult film. And I think that people who are interested in catching up on the Oscar contenders are going to definitely want to see it when it comes out wide starting today.
I'm curious about something. It just more broadly, whenever I go to live theater, just because of my background with it, I have to make an effort. And I mean, legitimately make an effort to take off the hat of watching people's technique, watching how they're handling this and that and so on, looking at the set design and, you know, the director's vision and what have you, and just go to enjoy it. Do you ever have the same problem or the same kind of requirement for yourself when you're out with your family to go and just enjoy a film? Or does the, you know, the work reflex jump in and you're watching for things and suddenly it's you're watching for the finite points of the production versus just the enjoyment of it?
You know, the truth is I get that criticism a lot from some family members that I don't just know how to enjoy things because I'm always being analytical about them. But the truth is that's where I get my enjoyment from it. I think people like, you know, movies or TV shows or plays or concerts because they've thought about the things enough to think that they like them. For me, my brain naturally thinks about a variety of things when I'm trying to decide whether I'm liking something or not. So it's really the kind of thing that's you can't separate it. It doesn't mean that I don't like, you know, quote unquote, dumber things or more superficial things or sillier things. I definitely like my fair share of those things too. But the phrase, you know, turn your brain off when you go to see things, I just have never understood that. I have to think about things, otherwise I wouldn't know if I liked them or not.
That's right. That's a fair point. Lastly, your beloved Boston Celtics, 26-18, 6.5 games out of the first position in the Eastern Conference. The player on the seas that I really have not been able to figure out this year is Gordon Hayward. He's a wonderful player. He has not come back this year, and I admittedly have not seen them as much as I'd like, but he's played in 40 games. He has not, to me, the reason the Celtics right now are sitting where they're at is because his production overall has been below where the Celtics thought it should be.
Yeah, I do think that's part of it. I think there are a lot of problems that they have, but Hayward is one of them. I mean, you know, he just isn't 100%.
Yeah.
Some nights he looks great. Some nights he looks real sluggish and a step slow and sort of off. And I don't really know that there's a great solution to that other than playing him. The problem is playing him when he's struggling both hurts the team on the court and takes away time from people like Jaylen Brown, who also hasn't really gotten into a consistent rhythm all season, I think, because they can't figure out the platoons here. So there's been a lot of problems with playing consistently, playing together. We'll see if they put it together. When they do, as you see against the Raptors, they are formidable. When they don't, well, they look like bums.
Well, a very nice synopsis to the week and to the Celtics. Thank you, my friend. We'll see you next week.
Looking forward to it. Have a great weekend.
All right. Folks, you guys have yourself a great weekend. Thanks to Derek Carr, Tony Landry, Nick Shager, and Russ. We'll see you on Monday. Until then, you're on your own.